You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds, and Danny V back again, all the way to the end of Solari Gentle's The Woman in the Library this time, the newest released book we've ever covered close to its release on the show, and I have to say, as we approach and reach and read the final chapter of this novel, that I am a very confused man.
Well, thanks all of us then.
Genuinely?
Yeah.
I'm so curious.
We reached the end of this book, and we have this lovely scene of Marigold and Freddy discussing the nature of the case, the nature of the crime, and then asking to themselves how they're going to leave without running into the press. And then the elevator door opens, and Leo says he's here to help. Now tell me, everyone, what did you think Leo meant by help?
Nothing good.
Can I be completely honest? When I first read this, I kind of skimmed the last couple of lines, went, oh, Leo's here. He's here to help. That sounds positive. But then I read it again and realized that he was standing in the corner of the elevator as they entered it and did not make his presence known until they were already halfway down to the murder basement. And I don't think I need to conclude that, but yeah, not great. It's so sad.
It's just so strange. It's so strange how Leo in Hannah's world and Leo in Freddy's world like keep converging and diverging. Leo in Freddy's world is so nice, and they're discussing relationships and what it means to love. And then Hannah's Leo is like, oh yeah, black people, they can't be in books. What are you on about? And it's like back to back.
Hold on. They can be in books, but you need to warn people if you're going to have a black person in your book, just in case.
Just in case. Just in case what, Leo?
You get attached to them or relate to the character, and then you realize they're black, and then it becomes a problem. That's how it works.
He has no filter, yeah, this guy.
But here's the crazy thing, right, is that those things seem so opposite, but Solari still manages to make it feel like it's coming from the same person. And it bewilders me.
Well, that's because he's such an unhinged person, because I think even when you read his emails, he is so up and down. One minute you think he's being, you know, he's articulate and intelligent and giving advice, and the next minute he'll have this really cynical, sort of almost scary dig at her. And so I think he's capable or incapable of regulating his emotions. So I think he can kind of almost put on any face he wants for small periods of time. I think he slips into, you know, the creep. But she does, his character, I think his character is one of the best I've ever read, and particularly in this book. He's so intriguing because there are no answers and we don't hear from Hannah, and there are still so many questions at the end. But he's a remarkable character. His voice is so strong.
Yeah, he's so credibly unhinged.
Yes.
I think is the main thing that I took away. Yeah. And I also love that we don't get an email from him in the last chapter, because of course the second last chapter has his email from prison where he's like, oh, sorry, it's a bit hard to email. The penitentiary rules are a bit strict.
They're draconian, he says. And he says, but don't worry, I've left some cupcakes in your kitchen.
Oh, you're like, you'd eat them. They were left on your bench.
I know.
Yeah, literally in her house.
Thank you so much. No. And no, you said to me one or two episodes ago, how would he get cameras into her house?
He got cupcakes there by flying there to visit where he was then sting operated by the FBI, I believe. So the cameras are probably there with the cupcakes, not before.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Wouldn't be eating those cupcakes.
I definitely wouldn't be eating those cupcakes.
I'd burn them and then sweep the room.
I don't think
cameras.
The FBI would let her eat those cupcakes if she tried. That's evidence.
There are a couple of elements of the wrap-up of this story. Like, you've obviously mentioned the fact that Leo shows up in an elevator with a knife and nothing more is said. But like,
is there a knife?
There's also the entire, no, there's not a knife.
He's there to cut the cupcakes.
Ah, there you go. Danny's got it. Thank you. But like, even we even have the whole struggle scene where they're like, oh, Marigold did it. And then they walk in on Wit and Marigold and Kane gets shot. And they're like, oh, well, I guess Wit's done it. He's the one holding the gun. They kind of stumble into the solution at the end, which is very strange. We don't actually know who got shot by the final gunshot. Like, I assume it was Wit, but I don't think it's actually confirmed. Correct me if I'm wrong, if I missed it, but like...
You're correct, but I think that also really neatly parallels what allegedly happened with Carolyn. because the claim that Whit makes is that he doesn't actually know how Carolyn died, even though he supposedly killed her. And it seems that it was like a similar scramble for the gun. And I think what Solari's done in that scene is shown what happened to Carolyn without answering the question directly through this first person perspective that kind of lends you the understanding of why Whit can't even answer that question when he's asked it.
I often find, you know, this chapter 33 in this book is when we sort of all, it all comes to a head and we find out, you know, that it's not Marigold, that it's Whit. And I sometimes fear those chapters in books because I feel like sometimes they're just an information dump. But I actually think Solari did it really well because I just feel like it was part of the action. You know, even though it was wrapping everything up, there was so much action in it. She continued the dialogue. She continued the character banter. There was confusion and a bit of chaos. But we managed to get our explanations without it feeling like that. Here is now my explanation dump of all the little loose ends that I'm going to tie up for you. So I didn't feel that, and it was quite refreshing not to feel that.
It's a bit of a cliche, but I definitely think that Whit having the gun and pointing it at our protagonist and saying, "I'll silence you," twiddling his mustache as he does, like, it's effective. Like, these characters, because obviously, like, Solari, she lives with her characters when she's writing a novel in the same way that Kane has his web of conspiracy because he's been embroiled in crime, and Freddie has her bus that she like travels on with her characters. And so the idea that these characters will continue to travel, or in the case of when we get to like Leo being in the elevator, maybe it's also okay to just like eviscerate your characters in a fountain of blood. Like, either way.
But don't forget, they overcame Whit with a gun. So, you know, there's a possibility that they could do it again.
It's true.
I'm sure that the real life character of Leo being given a character on in the story has no more power than Whit, who is based on nobody that we know of. I'm sure that's not like a through line that we could follow in metafiction in general. I'm saying their odds aren't likely is what I'm saying.
Yeah, the odds may not be great. I thought the example that was really interesting in that respect, though, in terms of like a bit of narrative disposability, though, is Boo or Sean Jacobs.
Oh, my goodness.
He shows up for like such a tiny bit and serves such a specific role in telling us like what these characters' pasts were, and then is offed so immediately.
He's so sad.
And it's really interesting how like metafictionally his narrative is justified through the times when Freddy, for example, goes to a bookstore, buys Kane's book and finally reads it and is like, oh, I start to see the pieces here. After so long, as I was saying, of her just being so enveloped in this very cringeworthy sense of romance.
Why do you hate romance, Flex? Why are you so against romance in your murder mysteries?
Discussing this with a listener, Herds, and I boiled it down with this listener to the fact that I think that most people's real life romances are really cringeworthy.
They are.
And that makes it really difficult to write a narrative romance that isn't cringeworthy.
See, I think most, are we talking about romances or relationships?
Both.
Because I hate to say it, but 90% of most relationships, after a while, they're boring, right? So I feel like people are looking for something in fiction that might be a bit cringeworthy, if you like, but I think people are looking for that because they've lost it somewhere in their own lives.
Maybe that's the truth. Maybe I'm just so successful that I don't need to read the cringe, Herds.
It's true. He has so many relationships. God,
that was painful to say. Why did I do that?
I don't know, Flags.
I think we need to do a romance novel. We need to do one of these Flex and Herds and just a special romance episode special.
Is this your invitation for us, Danny? Are we coming on Words and Nerds to read a romance book? Oh, God.
Why not? Oh, sure. Let's do that.
Listen, name a book and I suppose I'll be there.
Look, I'm not even a huge fan of romance. I definitely respect the genre because it's, you know, very popular. But I'm crime at heart, but we might just do it for fun. We might go Jane Austen.
Oh, that's dangerous. That's dangerous territory.
He's not anything but Jane Eyre. Good grief. Just do Dracula. That's got romance in it. Doesn't wait a
Flex
second.
Flex is now. He's turned my video off. He's kicking me off the Zoom. He's like, talking about Jane Austen.
You know, we may have to debrief a little bit while this next clip that we have with Solari airs. But I'm going to have to put a pause on this here. We'll be back to discuss the mystery at the end of the show after I've chastised Danny V. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are discussing Solari Gentil's The Woman in the Library all the way to the end. Full spoilers all in that. Solari's up next talking with us, and then we'll be back, as I said, to talk a bit about the mystery. Stick around. You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you. I'm about to throw you back over to the continuation of our discussion with Solari Gentle about The Woman in the Library. More of this discussion will be going up on the podcast later this week, where you can hear the full close to an hour of it. When we left off, we were talking about how Solari crafts her stories a bit like sculptures chiseled away from a block of proverbial marble. Let's jump right back into that. Past me, take it away.
I need to know, did you at any point give a draft reader of this book just Freddie's story or just Leo's emails? And if so, how did they fare?
No, I didn't. Because they didn't ever exist separately. So they were written in the order that you see them in the book. The one thing I did do, which was interesting, I sent the draft to Larry, and Larry commented on that very first draft, and I just put them into Leo's letters, his comments.
Is he going to cut of the profits on the book?
No. Don't get any ideas, Larry.
Poor Larry. He's the real victim in this story.
He's a wonderful writer himself, actually. So he could, so having that correspondence with someone who understood what it was to write, and that's why I did want to make Leo a writer as well, because there's a particular sort of understanding and relationship that goes with, you know, people who try and turn this into its whatever dubious profession it is.
One thing that makes Leo so painful in both layers of reality is his inability to see context, particularly when his email self starts talking about the entertainment value of global disasters that have killed millions, or joining protests just to get some violence in there, and like how convenient masks make the act of murder in general. Why is context so important to entertainment, Solari?
Look, I think the thing with Leo is that all of those things that he says could be said face-to-face as a joke and it would just be black humour. But when it's written, it's a different thing. There's an element of serious creep in it. So I think the thing that I realised through writing this novel is that there is a difference between the written word and the spoken word. So people say stupid things all the time and they make bad jokes that are inappropriate all the time. But when it's spoken, it's less, well, you don't have evidence of it 3 days later. What you see instead of Hannah's emails, you see the chapter that she writes in response. And I think what I was trying to say in that is that the most powerful way that writers speak is in the stories they write.
It makes me feel like the sort of through line here is that Leo is writing an email which should not be spontaneous, but his like surface thoughts or his, you know, the emotions that he's feeling are leaking into the emails.
Of course,
the further the story goes on.
Well, he's writing to a friend, and you do that with friends. You let that, because they treat that as a conversation. He thinks he's writing to a friend, and he is for the beginning.
Well, he thinks it's a friendship all the way through, or perhaps something more.
Something
whereas
more.
Hannah, of course, goes in the opposite direction.
You know what's really interesting about this? I've had beta readers read it. Those who weren't writers loved Leo in the beginning. They thought he was just lovely and giving and generous and funny. And every writer who read it hated him from page one.
Yep.
Can I tell you, we have a list of characters. You know how I said, like, I don't remember character names, so I'll just remember a thing about them. Leo, God, I hate him. That was his description. Because I didn't think anything else was significant enough.
I have a dear friend who we've been friends since we were 12, and she gets my first draft. Her comment on the manuscript was that she felt it was a bit of a shock when he suddenly turned into a bad guy. She didn't see it coming. Mm. And then I had also handed the manuscript to my friend Dan O'Malley, and he hated Leo from the minute. And he said, he's, you know, forget about murdering people, he's telling her how to write. So I kind of was hoping that people would actually not suspect him from page one as being evil, but clearly telling someone how to write is unforgivable.
Yeah, well, it becomes more explicit about his directions in her writing as it goes on. And I think that as much as I hate Leo, it is kind of tragic that he doesn't actually get to see the end of the book.
Yeah.
At the time of the final email, at least, he says, well, it's such a shame I'm in prison, but I hope that you really enjoyed showing us how awful Kane was and, you know, all of these things that he's like, obviously this is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is what I know you've done because we're on the same wavelength, right? Like all that stuff.
Well, look, I just hope he's never paroled and then reads the end of the book because Hannah's in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, speaking of the end of the book,
yes!
I say whilst carefully trying to avoid spoiling it, Crossing the Line's ending felt fairly concrete. Despite being open-ended, there was a sense that you knew exactly what came next, which I don't get as much from The Woman in the Library. There's perhaps a horrible threat in the ending, perhaps a warm welcome, but almost no way to tell if its danger is real given the separation between Email Leo and Freddy's neighbor Leo. What does Leo's rival at the end mean to you, or is the question the point?
It is. Well, a bit of both. In the end, I wanted Leo's arrival to weave the two stories together. So they were basically going along in parallel. And at that point, at some point they start to merge. And that's the point at which they become one. In a way, it's funny. So many people have interpreted this differently. My sister came to the end of that where Leo comes in and says, you know, I thought you might need my help.
Mm.
And she thought that that was a statement of, yeah, in the end, Leo was just trying to help her. and it was Hannah's acknowledgement of the fact that Leo was just trying to help her throughout.
It's so interesting.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
I like the idea, the way that I kind of came away from this novel, because look, I like to see the positive in things, is the idea that even though Leo was horrible and I hate him, she managed to take this horrible person and use him as a force for good, effectively, because the implication is that, like, Leo's going to help them get past the reporters at the end. He's going to like
it. Did you think that? I thought he was going to kill them in the elevator.
Really? Really? Is that really where we thought I was going?
Well, I thought that was a possibility. I thought it was creepy.
It is creepy.
I thought it was really creepy to be trapped in an elevator with this guy.
It is creepy, but
I clearly got way too hung up on the question here. I was like, oh, any of them could happen.
Any of them, truly any of them. That could be an
I like the idea that even though the real Leo is awful and we hate him, the Leo in the book can be a slightly more positive change. That's my dream, and don't crush it, Salah.
I should introduce you to my sister. She clearly has that kind of Disney spin on it. And look, and
sure, I love Disney. That's my whole brand image. Herds, the Disney fan. I can show you the world.
Don't get us copyright struck.
That's okay. That's all we got.
But I think, and again, it is, I really like the idea of readers walking away thinking. The ending, I hope, allows the reader a little bit of scope, because what we really want to do is we want to engage the reader enough that they care enough to imagine their own ending, or they care enough to decide whether that ending is creepy and dangerous or is a positive
butterflies and moment. Sunshine. Who knows? Yeah. It could be either.
And maybe there's a wedding on the horizon. I don't know.
Hopefully.
I know, but each to his own.
Yeah, right.
Each to his own, Felix.
I guess, you know, Freddie did nearly date one murderer. What's another? What's one more murderer?
Yes. It's tough for a book.
Solari, it has been wonderful having you back on Death of the Reader, and I have been delighted reading this novel and getting to discuss it with you. So thank you so much for joining us finally in person again.
Yes. Yes, isn't it wonderful? And it's always a pleasure, guys. I'll come back anytime. Even without a book.
You've been listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here, speaking with Solari Gentil. We will be back with more of The Woman in the Library in just a moment. Stick around. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour with Danny V from Words and Nerds. And we are here for the final debrief of Solari Gentil's The Woman in the Library, right up until review season, where we have to desperately try and not put it in first place again, because it feels a little silly giving Solari the award that she sponsors. Herds, I'll be honest.
We can't do it. We can't let her hand herself another award.
Why not?
At least not 2 years in a row. Because it just feels a little... It's just going to feed her ego.
And I'm handing... I award myself this award.
Like,
would you like to voice Solari?
It's entertaining, but I feel it tarnishes what little remaining credibility we have.
You could do one of those TikToks where she's actually handing herself an award. You know, there's two of her.
Maybe we should. Maybe, Herds, we should get into book talk. Maybe that's what we're missing.
Book talk? I haven't heard of book talk, but oh, see, I know what
I'm deeper
is.
In the rabbit hole than you are, I can tell.
Taking the world by storm, did you know?
I'm the old man.
All right, it's a bit of a tangent, right? But you know that there's a resurgence of these books that haven't been published or they're out of print for 10, 20 years because of book talk.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So they're putting them back on the map. And now bookstores actually have sections that say, you know, not crime or fantasy, but book talk.
Yeah. The big one that crossed our sphere, somewhat fittingly, metafictionally, is Cain's Jawbone blew up on book talk last year. The gimmick of that one basically being it's a murder mystery where all of the pages are out of order and the main mystery is having to put the pages back in order.
I would love to do that. The problem is you can only do it once. Like,
let's so, I think the three of us need to get together and do a book talk.
I don't think I think the problem is that we couldn't do just one. Like, if you're in book talk, you gotta kind of commit a little bit.
Gotta go deep.
Go to a series.
Anyhow,
flex.
The mystery of the woman in the library, I thought is fascinating, and I wanted to talk points. Herds.
Uh-oh.
You pulled a real clever, sneaky one, I thought, by putting your theory in the first week. You've probably noticed I've been trying and failing to do that every book so far this year, and you beat me to the punch, and I'm very irritated.
I figured I might as well go out swinging, especially with Danny V. I thought that, you know, Danny V's going to figure it out immediately, so I better have something of my own out so nobody can say that I've, like, stolen her idea.
Sorry to be so disappointing.
So, well, you know, no, look, I loved your theory. It was fantastic. But the point is, I thoroughly enjoyed having a crack in the first set of chapters. It is a challenge.
I think, Herds, I'm going to give you 3 points out of the possible four for this one.
That's generous.
Only topping you because I still don't understand how you thought Carolyn Palfrey was alive.
I thought that was going to be the twist. Look, as far as we know, Whit isn't even dead. They could have been a story with no murder except for, you know.
It was a very brave prediction, I'll give you that, but bravery is not accuracy.
Now, before you award me my points.
Please.
They're in an elevator. I think they're going down to the basement.
I agree. Danny, are you familiar with The Voyage of the Dawn Treader? Have you read C.S. Lewis's series of Narnia books?
Yes.
Okay, good. You know the little rat who's like, he's like a rat knight and he plays chess with all the kids and he's terrible at it because his mind was filled with valorous charges and selfless sacrifices. And so he just sucked at chess. That last part was not verbatim.
That's my
that was definitely
too.
My own words. But that's... that's how I approach murder mystery. I'm not here to win it. I'm here to charge my king forward, get it taken by the queen, and go, that was a good game. My king died valiantly.
Interesting.
Anyway, I'll take 3 points.
Now, here's what I'm going to suggest, Danny. The way that it works here on the show is that we have what we call the red shirts, the away team, for everyone who can't be on the show regularly so that their totals are all added up to compete against Herds and I.
Ah, interesting.
And what I was going to offer you is because spiritually... since Herds posed his final theory in the first week while you weren't here, that if you wanted, you could claim 3 points for the away team.
Don't do it. Oh, you screw me.
But if you feel guilty about it, I can award you 2 points for the theory that you gave us on last week's episode of the show. So, I mean, the choice is yours. Do you feel like taking the honorable way out or the frugal way out, you know?
The chivalrous way. Be that little rat knight. Look, I'm just saying, Danny... it's always down to the wire when we do points at the end of the year. And I don't think I've won yet. I could use an extra point. I'm just saying. Or 3 points, however many it is.
Interesting. Chivalrous or frugal? What? Who am I?
Who are you, Danny?
Are you a little rat? Are you an Edward or Edmund or whatever the heck his name was? He turned into a dragon, but it sucked.
God, I have to get chivalrous, Danny? Or I'm going to lose sleep over these. Oh, I overthink everything.
2 points for the away team then.
Oh,
Danny, I
hate myself.
I think the general approach to the theory in terms of like trying to find the mystery in like Leo's story is so much fun because even though the actual moment that we get to of Leo showing up in the elevator isn't necessarily or explicitly them going to that basement, but it is very much that moment, I think, of the writer being in Leo's presence and in danger that was really nice to see coming as the twist. Because of the way that Leo is portrayed as so intangible across the entire story, you know, he's never really doing any actions when he's in Freddy's world, and he's always so fictionally distant when he's in Hannah's that it's like it's really good fun to kind of see how he can physically enter the story at any point and actually, you know, use verbs for once.
I just thought it was very clever how, you're right, he was via email, then he was in prison, yet he was still very scary. And I thought that was very clever, particularly in a crime novel, because we're used to that person who creates fear in us being there, you know, being a presence, peeping through your windows, that kind of stuff. But he was not physically there for the most part, and yet he was still the most terrifying part of the novel.
I thought the thing that did frust me about this book's mystery, though, is the way that most of the, like, I guess answer clues is what I'd call them, the one that let you pick between your options, were consigned to the last third. It made it kind of difficult to divvy up the chapters in this, because there's a whole bunch of great moments, like when Marigold and Wit ask Freddy out for dinner, and Freddy declines, and then Wit bails, because what Wit's realized in that scene is, of course, that Kane is going to go and try and hang out with Freddy, and he's trying to manipulate Kane, so he needs to be there. He needs to somehow witness it.
But it's interesting, too, because that clue is covered or hidden by Marigold being upset by the whole, you know, romance. And so you miss it.
She's such an effective smokescreen.
But there's a possibility it's her right until the very end, you know, when she's outside Wit's window and we're thinking, oh, hang on. So, you know, she keeps us hanging in that space all the time. And it's interesting because it goes towards stereotypes as well. You know, like she's the sort of the strange girl.
The Freud girl.
She's got, you know, tattoos all over her torso, which I just loved about her. And so it's leaning into those stereotypes of she's got a bit of mystery about her and a bit of, you know, what's going on with her. So
we were talking earlier about how the romance kind of plays in this story and how, you know, Freddy doesn't see Kane's faults quite so clearly. But Marigold is in the pretty much the exact same situation. We've got these four friends, but really we've got two, like, romantic relationships. And in order for one of those four characters to be the murderer, unless it's Leo, of course, as Leo points out, it could be Leo, we have to interrupt one of these relationships. And if it were a love triangle, it could be kind of easy to pick the odd one out. But because it's two parallel pairs of characters, it's a bit trickier, I think.
That's a good point.
As you mentioned there, Leo, you know, Leo says, oh, maybe it could be me. But I almost thought that all the times that Leo's like, oh, maybe I could be the accomplice, maybe I could be the murderer, that, like, that was almost the clue that it wasn't, because, you know, Leo was leaning enthusiastically into the wrong answer every time.
He's a bit desperate, you know? Well,
that's his whole role, isn't it? Like, aside from his actual story that he has, aside from the actual story character aside from the actual story of his character, his whole point is, like, and I figured this out pretty quickly, to alight on answers that are incorrect. And that's like a big part of the reason why he's included in the book in the first place, is because it's like, it's the irony of it, that he thinks he can write a better mystery than the author of the novel. Right?
I think he's jealous of the fictional character too, Kane.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Anyhow, we should wrap this here. Danny, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on for these past two episodes. Before we let you go, where can people find Words and Nerds if they're curious to check it out?
You can find Words and Nerds wherever you listen to podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever else, all over social media, Danny V_Words and Nerds. Come and find me.
If you're a mystery nerd and you want to find a recent episode to dive into, the discussion with Ben Hobson and Annie Reynolds about And Then There Were None was fantastic. And I think if you're looking for an entry point coming from Death of the Reader, that's a good a point as any, but the show is generally wonderful, and Danny's obvious enthusiasm for books and writing in general is just such a treat. So it's so good having you on finally after all this time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I was, like I said, scared, nervous, anxious, excited, all of the above, but it was fantastic talking about this wonderful book with you, and you guys are really smart. I had to bring my A game tonight.
If you say so, look, I'll take it.
Speaking of terrifying things, Herds.
Yes, the next book. You're going to love this one, Flex. I hope you're excited for more libraries. We'll be covering The Body in the Library by Agatha Christie. That's right. It's our Christie for the year.
Our one Christie. The murder mystery reviewer's equivalent of filing their taxes.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And we're going to be covering, this being the second of the Great Miss Marple books, we're going to be covering chapters 1 to 8 and seeing what's been going on in an old man's mansion and what kind of body he might wake up to in his library. It's going to be great.
Spooky. Alrighty.
Horrifying.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We will be back with The Body in the Library by Agatha Christie, chapters 1 to 8 next week on the show. Thank you for tuning in to your Murder Mystery World Tour. We'll see you then.